Aloha. Welcome to The Conversation, Hawaii Talks. I'm Catherine Cruz. A federal judge has partially unsealed a fraud complaint filed against defense contractors working at the Red Hill fuel facility. The Justice Department has opted not to pursue the case, but what does that complaint say about what may have led to the Red Hill fuel spill and contamination of drinking water? We'll explore that against the backdrop of Easter as we come off the holiday. On The Long View, we talk about the economy. Is it hot or not? We take a closer look at the investigations into what led to the Maui wildfires. Still no report 8 months after the tragedy that left more than 100 people dead. And with the demand for childcare through the roof, we'll hear about local efforts to increase recruitment and retention in the childcare sector. This is The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. Lots of Red Hill developments in the days leading up to the big Easter celebrations this weekend as we were all preparing to sit down with loved ones for a holiday feast and perhaps an egg hunt or two. So let's recap some of those things, as you may not have been aware that they were underway. What was happening may not have been fully visible to most people. So today we are bringing you a collection of conversations like a basket of Easter eggs. First off, Navy Secretary Carlos de Toro was in town. He gave a speech at a ceremony on the deck of the USS Battleship Missouri Thursday, transferring power over the draining of the Red Hill underground fuel facility from a joint effort of different forces to the official closure, a big deal since control of the mission is back in Navy Region Hawaii's hands. It was under its watch that the fuel got into the military's drinking water system and displaced thousands of military families. Here's del Toro.
As we all know too well, the original fuel spill that led to the eventual contamination of the Red Hill well took place in May of 2021. Shortly after the second spill in November, I, as then the new secretary, immediately directed all operations to cease at Red Hill. Secretary Austin then stood up Joint Task Force Red Hill to defuel and then permanently close Red Hill. And the team here, Navy Region Hawaii, the Joint Task Force, federal, state, local officials, communities, families, Native Hawaiians, all came together to make things right. Together as a community, we worked hard because it was our responsibility to do so for the benefit of all Hawaiians and for all our service members, and for all the future generations of those who will call Hawaii their home. Today, we are marking the transfer of authority of Red Hill. But more importantly, we are pledging continued collective commitment because there is still much work to be done, as has been said before. Seamlessly, from Commander Joint Task Force to Commander Navy Closure Task Force, we transfer the charge of the task and with it the responsibility to always be laser focused on the health and safety of the people, the community, and the environment.
We did ask to talk to the Navy Secretary, but we were told no, his schedule didn't allow for it. He was too busy. It's not clear if he knew that a federal judge would be partially unsealing a complaint filed by Lieutenant Commander Shannon Banks, who was fuels director at Red Hill. 2 years ago, she filed a fraud complaint against defense contractors at considerable risk to her military career. The complaint raised questions about whether the contractors did the maintenance work they were paid to do. If so, why were more than 200 repairs required to the pipe system before those fuel tanks were drained? Banks says she tried to let higher-ups know about her suspicions that something was not right at Red Hill. The Justice Department looked into it and Friday decided it would not pursue the case. We've not been able to talk to anyone directly to understand why. Banks and her attorneys agreed to withdraw their complaint, which alleged that the contractors failed to properly maintain the system and that the Navy relied on that representation. Consider that snapshot and probe added pressure to Vice Admiral John Wade, the pressure of safely defueling more than 100 million gallons of fuel from 20 underground tanks was already on his shoulders. He had not seen the tanks before getting his orders to defuel more than a million gallons. Here's part of a candid conversation that we had with Admiral Wade early last week.
So every day for the last 18 months, I've come to Ford Island, I park my car, and I see Kapukaki. And I think about those impacted, I think about the connections, I think about our duty to serve others, I think about working hard, and that's what's driven my team each and every day. So while there has been criticism, I accept it because I know that people are angry, frustrated, disappointed. But again, all I could do is focus on what I could control, and that was to be safe and to do it as quickly as possible and then to execute it flawlessly.
So be honest, did you have very many sleepless nights before you started this process?
I had many sleepless nights, but that's okay. You know, I was asked to lead this team, and I didn't want to fail. So, yeah, there was a lot, but that's where practice comes in and rehearsals. And again, I'm so thankful to so many. And I would like to just at this point highlight the important role of the regulators. I mentioned that we had to work by, with, and through both the EPA and the Department of Health. You know, they held us to a standard, both federal and state law. But they also worked with us collaboratively, but still maintaining their oversight responsibilities to find efficiencies and optimize the schedule together. And then when we presented options to move faster but safely, they had to bring in more capability, more capacity, and they did so.
That was Vice Admiral John Wade. We can tell you that Commander Shannon Banks was transferred to Marine Corps Base Hawaii in Kaneohe. And in an unusual move, the Navy commander showed up at a recent Red Hill Community Representation Initiative public meeting. HBR was there back in February. Banks offered her expertise as a fuel director and shared insight into what some say could be the more dangerous part of the closure because of the vapors in the massive tanks. Dangerous not just for the workers inside, but surrounding neighborhoods.
Where are you going to put out the vapors? So now that you defueled the tanks and the pipelines, now there's poisonous, toxic fumes in those tanks. And the only way to vent them out is through the top of Red Hill and then through the adits. Are you going to notify the families when you start venting those out? Because that's extremely toxic and it will flow down to Halaba Valley, down to Pearl Harbor.
Now, the military said 4 of the 20 underground tanks have already been cleaned, but there's 16 more to go. But let's get back to the deck of the USS Missouri. We asked Admiral Stephen Barnett, who takes over responsibility for this next phase, about addressing Lieutenant Commander Banks' concerns about making sure that a petroleum engineer was on the team. We also asked about his first impressions of seeing those massive tanks for the first time.
I went to engineering school, so I am an engineer. I'm not a professional engineer, but I think with my team, I know just enough to be able to ask those questions, you know, that can make us think outside of the box so we can do this safely and do it as efficiently and as quickly as possible.
I asked Admiral Wade this question, and I'll ask you, what were you struck by when you walked into those tanks for the first time?
Ma'am, this is my second tour living here. First tour, I was at the Marine Corps base and used to fly. And I had been driving up and down H3 all these years and never knew it was there. So when I came back this time, when Admiral Paparo brought me back to be part of this solution here, I went in for the first time and it utterly shocked me of just the immenseness of it. And you know, how many tanks and what had been here within plain sight that I hadn't seen. It is a big project, but I've got a great team. I think what you'll see here from the people that are here is more importantly is we have support from the state all the way back to the mainland to do the job right and to get the resources that we need.
And getting back to that fraud complaint, we talked to Sierra Club Hawaii this morning. It has been battling the Navy since the 27,000-gallon fuel leak some 10 years ago, January 2014. And environmentalists haven't been happy as they believe the Navy has been hiding the eggs of information about the Red Hill leaks for decades. Here's Executive Director Wayne Tanaka on learning of the fraud complaint lodged against 5 contractors, some of whom are still doing work related to Red Hill.
You know, one of the things that struck me was some of the details that the complaint alleged about the hotel pier leak that HPR reported on in 2021. You know, this was a leak that Navy officials failed to disclose when they were under oath during our contested case hearing. And at the time when we found out about that, to us it just demonstrated you know, their willingness to hide the truth, and also that their, you know, their so-called system of systems couldn't actually detect active leaks from their facility. You know, according to the complaint and the allegations in there, if true, there's actually a direct link between the hotel tray leak and a defueling line and the later explosion, essentially, from the JP5 line that released 21,000 gallons of fuel in the May of that year.
The claim that contractors may have cut corners and that led to the fuel getting into the drinking water is, you know, disconcerting. And we saw how many repair work orders had to be issued before they could even begin draining all those tanks. So it does make you question, you know, what was going on there.
Yeah, and that's another huge question, right? Like, you know, this facility that was supposed to be, you know, in top shape and was exceeding industry and regulatory standards, why did it take so long? Why did it take 200 repairs just to get it to safely defuel itself, which is, you know, what it was be designed to do? And so if you look at the complaint, it does kind of detail a lot of the, you know, alleged neglect on the part of contractors to really do what they were paid to do and inventory all of the needed repairs and parts needed to be replaced and maintenance procedures that needed to be done. And, you know, in some sense, you know, if true, that would explain just the incredibly decrepit nature of the facility that we eventually learned about.
Yeah, and to be clear, we're talking about the piping system, not so much the tanks, because, you know, we were told all along, you know, the tanks have been regularly maintained, but the fact that they did put in plastic pipes where there should have been steel pipes. You know, why get something off the shelf in a facility of this magnitude?
You know, and that was a huge safety concern that was, you know, described in the complaint is the use of PVC for their fuel suppression system, which was totally not okay. You can't use like meltable plastic pipes as a part of your fire suppression system when a fire itself would cause those pipes to fail. And unfortunately, it's, what we know now is that the use of PVC actually made the fire suppression drain line vulnerable to ruptures, which is what happened in November of 2021.
And this complaint talks about bad foam, you know, the firefighting foam, the toxic forever chemicals.
So what happened was, you know, the Navy recognized that its firefighting foam back in 2015 was particularly toxic. And so the contractors, you know, according to the complaint, we're supposed to basically rebuild a fire suppression system, drain and get rid of all of the quote-unquote bad foam so they could replace it with less toxic form of AFFF. That was never done. And another revelation, I guess, in the complaint, or at least in its allegations, was the more information on the number and location of AFFF spills, because it turned, you know, according to the complaint, and as we know, November 2022 was not the first instance of AFFF being released from the facility, and complaint details four prior instances in 2019 and twice in 2020 and then in 2021 where this faulty fire suppression system inadvertently released water with residual AFFF, which was the bad foam. And, you know, there are, I think, still, you know, if those allegations are true, I would have questions about the extent of remediation that was done and if, you know, that those spills were adequately cleaned up, because in the complaint itself, it talks about the failure of contractors to appropriately remediate the environment after these prior spills.
And we also asked officials with the State Health Department, the Environmental Protection, as well as the State Department of Education for comment and have yet to hear back. There are still lingering questions about why the contaminants continue to show up in the drinking water if all of the jet fuel has been safely drained from the tanks. Just as the ceremony on the USS Missouri was getting underway last week, the DOH and DOE issued an advisory saying the water at Hickam Elementary School was safe to drink after high levels of TPH, the total petroleum hydrocarbons, were initially found earlier in the year. Retests showed that the water was safe. So that's still the other mystery. What's in the water? Where is it coming from? Another egg to find, and that hunt is on. Stay tuned.
Support for HPR comes from Waimea Valley on Oahu, launching its Kipaheli Tour Series, featuring a behind-the-scenes look at the valley's history, culture, and land. Registration for a botanical or cultural tour at waimeavalley.net.
I'm Bert Lum. Today on Bite Marks Cafe, we find out how the field of cybersecurity has grown to be of international concern. We'll talk to local nonprofit Cyber Hawaii to learn what they're doing to prepare our residents and businesses to be cyber safe. That's this evening at 6:30 on Bite Marks Cafe.
Support for HPR comes from the Scheidler College of Business at UH Manoa, celebrating 75 years, offering the global MBA with 21-month, 24-month, and 36-month options. Scheidler.hawaii.edu.
Almost 8 months after the Maui wildfires, we have yet to see results on the many investigations into the cause of the blaze and our response to the disaster. Here to talk about that is HPR reporter Savannah Harriman-Pote. Hi, Savannah.
Hi, Catherine. Thank you for having me.
Yes. So where are we at with all these probes?
Right. So there's a number of investigations underway, many of which have been significantly delayed, but April is the month in which we might finally get some insights. So on April 17th, the Department of the Attorney General is expected to release a report with a comprehensive timeline of events during the first 72 hours of the fire. And then we're on the lookout for another report, which could drop by the end of April, from Maui Fire Department, that they're preparing along with the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms and Explosives. And that looks into the cause of the fire. So why did the fire start? Where did it start, and who is responsible? That's what that report will hopefully answer. But some lawmakers think that our Public Utilities Commission should really be taking the lead in investigating how the fire started and specifically answering that question, what caused the fire?
Okay, and so what's the problem? Why aren't they doing that?
Well, the main concern among lawmakers and the reason why they want the Public Utilities Commission to take a closer look is that we've left the investigation up to the state and Maui County, and both of those agencies, or both the state and the Maui County, are facing liability for the fire. So they are hoping that the PUC can be more of an independent probe into what caused the fire. I spoke specifically to Senator Jarrett Keohokalole. He is particularly concerned with Maui County's role in figuring out the cause of the fire. And this all came to a head a few weeks ago in his committee, the Senate Committee on Commerce and Consumer Protection, which he chairs. And the committee had passed a resolution saying that the PUC had, quote, failed in its duty to investigate the cause of the fire.
So what did the senators mean by that?
Well, the PUC, the Public Utilities Commission, is required by law to investigate any loss of life related to the operations of Hawaii's utilities, but state statute isn't specific on when or how that investigation should take place. And in its written testimony on the resolution, the PUC laid out several steps that it has taken since August to fulfill its statutory mandate, but lawmakers were just not impressed by any of those steps. They want to see the PUC open a formal public proceeding, what we call a docket. Here's Keohokalole.
You know, there was an argument over what is expected and required of the PUC to fulfill that mandate. Our position is basically that there's no official investigation that's taken place, and so there are no results of an investigation that we can view and that we can expect at this point because they haven't opened an investigation. So, you know, the PUC's position that, you know, their participation in all of these different aspects of the wildfire response and the other investigations that are taking place is sufficient to fulfill their requirement. That's not good enough.
Yeah, so he seems to think that the PUC doesn't want to open up a docket.
And the PUC has offered a few explanations as to why they've held off until now. One is that they don't want to duplicate efforts of other agencies, and the senators have made clear their concerns on that front. The other is that they say they don't have the resources to mount an investigation of the kind that the senators are expecting. And I spoke to a spokesperson from the commission. They say that they currently do not have any staff that are solely dedicated to a full-time wildfire investigation, though that may change depending on the results of the Attorney General's report and the report from the Maui Fire Department, as well as what legislation we see pass in the next couple of months. But when lawmakers heard that argument in testimony on that resolution, they largely rejected it, saying that if the PUC did not have sufficient resources to mount an investigation, they should have come to lawmakers at the start of the legislative session and asked for more funds, which is what the Attorney General's office did to conduct its investigation.
Well, wouldn't a PUC typically investigate the cause of wildfires?
So that's a sticky question, right? I wanted to look into this more because the PUC is saying that that's not in their purview, that that's not required by state law. And so I went to the California Public Utilities Commission, and I spoke with Forrest Kayser. He's the Deputy Executive Director of Safety and Enforcement, and he oversees a team of 15 people at the California Public Utilities Commission who conduct wildfire investigations and then also work on California's public power shutoff program. So a lot more robust than what we have here in the islands. They've actually been consulting with our public utilities commissions to see if there's anything in their procedure that we could apply in Hawaii moving forward. But even that team of, 15 people who have been working for more than 5 years with a set procedure in place on what happens when a wildfire breaks out, they don't investigate what causes a wildfire. Forrest Kayser said that's just a very, very specific skill set, and so they leave it up to their local, state, and fire agencies. But when I explained the situation in Hawaii, Kayser said he wasn't aware of a single incident in California where agencies implicated in a fire have also been tasked with investigating themselves. So what's happening in Hawaii, the implications for the report based on Maui County and the state's role in lawsuits is really unique.
Yeah, I mean, it is a bit of a head-scratcher, folks might be worried about something getting whitewashed.
Yeah, certainly. I will say I reached out to the Public Utilities Commission to talk about this directly, and they declined an interview, though Commissioner Colin Yost did say in testimony before the senators that the PUC, the Public Utilities Commission, was prepared to change course if necessary. I also spoke with Henry Curtis. He's the Executive Director of the Community Action Group, Life of the Land, and he's been involved with the PUC on a number of fronts as an intervener in different proceedings. And he was surprised that they're being, in his words, so passive on this issue.
Historically, the PUC has investigated any deaths, regardless of whether it was directly linked to utilities. So for example, the PUC investigated people falling off boats or dying on railroad tracks when railroads were covered by the commission. And in all of those cases, the investigation was opened almost immediately. The Public Utilities Commission asserts that this particular section of law does not say when they have to open an investigation. However, if you look throughout all of state law, practically all sections of law do not say, you must do this now. It simply says, this is the law. And that is what this section says. This is the law. If there's an accident, you open an investigation. To assert that every single section of law that tells every agency what to do has to have a sentence in it that says, do this now, is absurd.
Well, I imagine, though, there's a legislation, trying to deal with this.
There are a number of bills that are coming through the House that are looking at different aspects of the wildfire response. And Henry Curtis has concerns about transparency in those, too. For instance, one bill, Senate Bill 2922, which is actually introduced by Senator Keoho Kalole, would create a process for electrical utilities to develop and submit wildfire protection plans to the Public Utilities Commission. And that bill would not necessarily require the PUC to approve of those plans in a formal proceeding or in a docket. So Henry Curtis is saying that we need to be serious about transparency in all aspects of how we're investigating and responding to the wildfire.
Okay, and that bill is up for review today?
Yep, that has a Senate hearing at 2:30 today in front of the Finance Committee in the House.
All right, well, thank you so much, Savannah.
Thank you.
That was HPR Savannah Harriman-Pote. Look for her stories on hawaiipublicradio.org. Do you think our economy is struggling? Well, you're not alone. For the Long View Today, our contributing editor Neil Milner joins us to talk about why so many Americans think the economy is bad, despite numbers to the contrary. Good morning, Neil.
Good morning.
Yeah, so is it hot or is it not?
It's a mystery. It's a disconnect that can be explained to some extent by some kind of short-term factors, and to another extent, it's not really a mystery at all because there are long-term things that are changing it. So this is the situation in a nutshell, and we'll be looking at one piece by the Poynter Institute that looks at the short-term factors and another piece by a noted political analyst, Nate Silver, that looks at the long-run stuff. First of all, the economy is doing, by lots of measures, very well. Unemployment is down, inflation is down, there just is a lot of good things happening. The labor market is very good. The stock market is up. But there is no indication that the public really accepts that. They're very pessimistic about the economy. Only about, in recent surveys, less than a third think the economy is in good shape. And they're generally pretty pessimistic about it. So it used to be that if you were poor, you voted Democratic, and if you were wealthier or had some money, you voted Republican. That's a complicating factor here, and we'll get to that in a minute. So the overall argument is that there is a disconnect. When you look at the disconnect, you can explain some of it, but long term, it may be that from now on into the near future, it's no longer the economy, stupid, which is what people used to argue, and which a lot of people, Biden supporters, say he's got to work harder to convince folks that the economy is doing well. So we'll look at both the short-term side and the long-term side.
Well, you know, I think a lot of folks are probably, you know, just looking at their day-to-day, right? They're seeing prices in the grocery store go up, and they're probably a little unsettled with all the political hot spots in the world and how all that might, you know, affect what's happening here.
Well, putting the hot spots aside for a second, that is what the Poynter Institute points out, that others have too, that the way people view prices and inflation every day is not the way that measures usually operate. Measures usually operate in terms of, you know, it drops, it doesn't drop. The average consumer is more concerned about the visibility of certain objects, and you mentioned the grocery store and car prices and things like that. Those are things that are pretty immediate to their lives. And they see them going up. They would like them to go down, even though prices don't go down after an inflation. They just rise in a more slow way. People have expectations that they want things to be better and that they're not getting better. One of the things, for example, is that you fight inflation by raising interest rates. When you raise interest rates, it becomes more expensive to get a loan and a mortgage, and then it's harder to buy a house. So you got people who are maybe making more money than they did before, but are seeing it going away into the grocery store or into other high-ticket items, or still can't afford to live, still can't afford to buy a home. And so it's not a question here of who's right or who's wrong. It's a question of seeing the world in two very different ways. And someone like Biden is trying to get people to see the economy in a more optimistic way, which is the way Democrats used to be able to do it. They would be able to convince people more, because the way things used to work, and this gets us to longer-term factors and to Nate Silver stuff, the way things used to work is that poor people with less income, voted Democratic heavily, and the higher you became in your economic class, the less likely you were to vote Democratic and the more likely you were to vote Republican. That has flattened. It started to flatten in 2000, well, actually a little bit before Trump ran for president, where you found more and more working class people, initially white working class people, and now increasingly Hispanic and a little bit African American, starting to leak into the Democratic Party. By the same token, the most important difference in America right now is not economic class, it's education. And what's happened is that people with higher education levels, let's say some college or lots of college, are the strongest Democratic supporters. You know, not the rich ladies in the suburbs who used to go to Episcopal churches and vote Republicans. They're now a little bit more likely to vote Democratic. And poor people are more likely to vote Republican. And if you look at the information that that Nate Silver has, Silver, by the way, says he studied the relationship between economics and elections probably more than anybody has since 2012. I believe he's got good DNA. His dad went to graduate school with me, so he's picked up some of his stuff from his dad. But if you look at the statistics, they're really interesting, because if you go back into the 80s, even when Republicans did well, you could just look at the chart and go right down the list. The heaviest Democratic vote were the people with the least income, and it just went right down in an opposite direction. The more money you made, the more Republican. That's almost equal now. That is, if you look at the last elections, the percentage of people who vote, let's say, Democratic, are pretty much the same or close to being the same for every income group. So you can't make the same kind of economic arguments with the same success anymore. So you start finding cultural differences that start showing up. You start finding things that poor people may want that people with higher degrees of education are not as interested in. And so that's it, and that's a long-term factor. That seems to be something that's becoming pretty permanent. The more permanent it becomes, the harder it is to make the same old arguments about the importance of the economy. That is, Joe Biden can go out and say, look at how well the economy is doing. It used to have more of a resonance from the people that would normally vote Democratic. Not so much anymore, because that's changed and people have different interests. And one of the things that Silver says that's controversial, I think, he says two things. First of all, there's economic issues that highly educated people want that or don't have much interest in that working class people do. The other thing is, Silver says that there's no indication, as far as he's concerned, that all of this emphasis that Biden is putting on democracy as a way to win people over, you know, that Trump is a threat to our democracy and so on. Silver says that's something that's more likely to resonate with higher educated people and of less interest people that are not as well educated tend to vote Republican. So you start seeing a few things that really are important here. One, the old argument that it's the economy stupid doesn't hold so much, certainly not in this election. There are too many other things going on. Two, some of this is about the little factors here, about the difference between inflation as measured in one way and inflation as perceived in another. But three, what's really happening now is a very different relationship between the amount of money that you make and how you vote. That the old link between blue collar and Democratic and white collar and Republican is one of the few kinds of polarizations that's becoming less polarized. We're flattening in terms of the relationship between economics and vote preference.
Yeah, and a lot of folks are just worried about why their favorite joint is closing down.
Well, yeah, you know. I mean, that's always, this is a kind of overall global explanation, and there are other things that we really didn't talk about here, you know, some of the cultural stuff, for example. But people are generally, you know, these patterns are pretty stable for long periods of time about the relationship between class and vote, but not so much anymore.
All right. Well, thanks so much, Neil.
You're welcome. Take care.
Okay. We've been talking to our contributing editor, Neil Milner. Look for his articles that are referred to on our website later today.
On the next Fresh Air, the controversial legacy of Captain James Cook. We talk with historian Hampton Sides. His new book is about the British sea captain's four-year voyage to chart lands from the Arctic Circle to the South Pacific. His treatment of indigenous people left him regarded by many as an agent of colonialism. Join us.
Beginning this afternoon at 3, following On Point.
HPR brings you music that captivates the soul and storytelling that embraces our humanity. Whether they're set to melodies or delivered by spoken word, stories weave us together. HPR is committed to bringing you these stories. Show your commitment to HPR with a $10 monthly gift. Donate today at hawaiipublicradio.org.
Pandemic-era federal funding to keep childcare businesses afloat in Hawaii is set to expire this year. It comes at a time when demand for childcare has skyrocketed, but many are leaving the industry because of the low pay. Deborah Zeisman is the executive director for the nonprofit Hawaii Children's Action Network, HICAN. She says with more parents returning to the workplace, there's only one open spot at a childcare facility for every four children. The conversation's Russell Subiono sat down with Zeisman this morning.
Can you give us an update on how needs have changed in the childcare industry here in Hawaii?
It has been a wild, I think, 5 years for families and for childcare providers, both here in our state and across the nation. Just a lot of changes. And so compared to a couple of years ago, we now have families back at work, whereas 2 years ago, a lot of families were still staying home, especially with young children. A lot more remote work than we see now. People still concerned about health. Now we are seeing people wanting to return to work, even if they are still working remotely in need of child care. And we've seen some new investments from the state as well, so some areas of growth. What's also coming up shortly, though, is that the federal stabilization of child care is ending in 2024. So that has us very concerned.
Can you touch on that last part a little bit, why that is a big concern?
Yeah. First and foremost, Hawaii had a child care shortage even before the pandemic. We know that there is actually only one child care spot for every four children, right? So one out of four across the state. Some parts of our state are really bad, especially our rural communities. There may be no spots of child care, especially for our youngest kids, no matter how much you can pay. It was bad before. And leading up to the pandemic, we were seeing declines in the number of child care providers. It's estimated we lost about 20% of our child care spots even before the pandemic. Folks were just closing. Largely, they were saying they just couldn't afford it. They weren't making enough money to be in that business anymore. They were leaving the sector for other jobs, even if they loved taking care of young children. One thing we did see during the pandemic was the recovery funding that happened during the pandemic. There was quite a bit of federal money that came to our state, and our state helped push some of that money out to childcare providers to help keep them functioning and open, right? So they provide some supplemental money out to childcare. So even if their counts of children were going up and down, or families were staying home, or there were extra costs because of the need for ventilation and extra cleaning and things like that, there was federal funding to help keep the child care providers open, since they are a part of our infrastructure. That's how we think about it. The child care is a part of our infrastructure. So the federal government recognized that financial support was needed to keep child care open. that money ends this year. So the last of that money is going out from Department of Human Services now to help the child care providers recruit staff, keep staff, things like that.
And so now that more parents are returning to the workplace and there's a higher demand for child care, so I imagine that many are turning to lawmakers to find solutions to the problem. Can you talk about HB 1964 and how you hope it will impact the needs in the child care industry?
So House Bill 1964 is still moving through the legislature. We are really hopeful it will make it to the end and get funded. And what it does is continue state funding in the same way that the feds were providing during COVID. So providing extra money out to the child care sector so that largely so folks can recruit and retain workers. That's the biggest problem we have right now is pay for child care and early learning providers is very low. University of Hawaii did a study a year and a half ago and found that the average wage for our child care professionals at that time was $13 to $17 an hour. So that's like $31,000 a year. It's well below a living wage. And we hear from child care providers all the time. They might have a bachelor's degree in the field. They love working with young children, and they simply can't afford it because their own costs have gone up in the last few years. They just can't. They can't make it. They can't put food on their own family's table. And with inflation as well, many of our child care providers and preschools, they might rent space. Rent has gone up in the last few years. They often provide lunch and snacks to children. All those food costs have gone up. And families are still very strapped. So I think the problem we're trying to solve here is we want to make child care affordable for families. We don't want to charge families more because they're already paying quite a lot of money. We need to grow the sector. We need to have more seats. And so the only way really to do that is with more government money going in to help build out that infrastructure.
Are wages the only obstacle or the primary obstacle to bringing more workers into the workforce? Are there other facets as to why recruitment and retention has been a challenge? You know, like, are kids different or are... Are rules different? Is there more oversight now or something? I mean, like, I'm just curious as to whether there might be other factors.
Honestly, I would say not really. It's wages. If you talked, and from that study that University of Hawaii did, for example, it's wages. This is true nationwide. Preschools, you know, and child cares, they are losing staff to places like retail, restaurant industry, even if they have a degree in the field, because the pay is higher. And folks often say they're incredibly sad, but they simply can't do it. You know, they just say, I just can't provide for my own family at $15 an hour. It just doesn't work. I haven't heard from providers that kids are different. Child care and preschool has always been pretty regulated. We have folks taking care of our youngest children, so we want to make sure that there's safety measures in place. Those have always been the case. The challenge frequently to getting existing child care providers to be willing to scale and serve more families or new places to open up. People take a look at, you know, the math doesn't pencil out when you talk about running this as a business. And people say, ooh, never mind, I will go into a different sector.
Maybe it's helpful to see it as an investment in their safety, you know, at a young age. That might be a good way to look at it, too.
100%.
But I imagine...
I think it's an investment in our children, but I think the framing for us is that we need to start thinking as a community about child care and preschool as part of our community infrastructure, the same way we think about DOE, right, like K-12. We don't question if that should be funded. The same way we think about police and fire. This is infrastructure that we just need in the community. Some families will be like yours and will have parents, grandparents, aunties, uncles take care of their children. And many, many folks in our state will at some point in time need child care from birth up to kindergarten. And then also things like after school and summer and things of that sort as well. Like with all adults in many households, all adults work, and therefore where do the kids go? That's my house, right? My husband and I both work full-time. We have two kids. We want to make sure that our kids are in a safe environment during the day while we're at work. That's how we're able to go to work and feel okay about things.
For any issue this big and this far-reaching, it seems that providing incentives through the law is maybe just one part of the solution. It seems like the ultimate solution has a lot of different facets to it and a lot of different mm-hmm. points to it. What else can parents or employers or the community do to contribute to solving the larger issue?
As you said, there is no magic solution here. It is multifaceted. We will need everything from an increase in facilities. I think that's where businesses can sometimes help. You know, can they provide childcare on site for families, their employees? I think it is sometimes neighbors helping neighbors and families reaching out to see how they can support families as well. I certainly think it is government, it's all of our taxpayer dollars saying that this is an important thing for our community to invest in, which is what we've seen in many other states across the nation, is we have to invest in our youngest kids. I think it's all those things together.
I know that HB 1964 will be heard at the Ways and Means Committee meeting on Thursday at 10:15, I believe. Is this an opportunity for the public to weigh in and voice their opinion?
We highly encourage folks to submit testimony if you are able and willing. Or actually, I think even more important is for folks to find out who your representative is, who your senator is, where you live, and make just a quick phone call to that office and say that it's important to invest in our children. It's important to invest in childcare and just explain why that's important to our families.
Deborah Zeisman, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you for covering it.
That was Deborah Zeisman from the Hawaii Children's Action Network talking to HBR's Russell Subiono. We will have links on the conversation page of our website later today. This is a conversation on Hawaii Public Radio. We now go to this week's Manu Minute. University of Hawaii at Hilo Professor Patrick Hart introduces us to an endangered native bird with a singular call and unusual crest.
Akoekoe are the largest honey creepers remaining in Maui Nui and are just a spectacular bird. Measuring about 7 inches from bill to tail, they're mostly shiny black, but their feathers are tipped in orange, silver, and white to give them a beautiful speckled appearance. They also have bright orange necks and a very unusual fluffy white crest on their forehead, which is where their English name, crested honeycreeper, comes from. Why they have this crest, no one really knows. One possibility is it helps attract the opposite sex, but another more likely possibility as it makes them better at dispersing pollen between the many flowers they visit throughout the day. This is important because akoekoe are nectarivores, meaning that nectar from a variety of native flowers is their main food source, though they spend most of their time sipping nectar from ohia lehua trees. Other nectarivores that compete for food with akoekoe include the orange-red iivi and the brick-red apapane. Being the biggest of the three, akoekoe are able to chase away the others from their favored foraging areas. Like many other Hawaiian birds, the name akoekoe may come from some of the many sounds that they make. If you use your imagination, sound a little bit like their name. Akoekoe once ranged throughout Maui and Molokai, but today are only found in a relatively small patch of wet forest high up on the side of Haleakala volcano. With less than 2,000 birds left, they're considered to be critically endangered and are a major focus of conservation efforts from a variety of groups, including the Maui Forest Bird Recovery Project. Like most of our remaining honeycreepers, akoekoe are very susceptible to mosquito-transmitted avian malaria. And one recent study that used radio transmitters to track the movements of adults and juveniles found that while adults rarely leave the safety of their mosquito-free territories at high elevations, the juveniles travel widely across the landscape, including lower elevation forests that may have plenty of nectar resources, but also have disease-carrying mosquitoes. This, plus the fact that Akoe-Koe only have one or two babies per year, is a major reason why their populations continue to decline, despite there being plenty of forest left on Maui for them to live. For Hawaii Public Radio, this is Patrick Hart from the UH Hilo Department of Biology.
Support for Manu Minute comes from Evergreen by Deborah, providing tile, mosaic murals, and planters for 30 years. At evergreenbydeborah.com, learn more about HydroFlow permeable pavers designed to absorb rainwater and reduce runoff.
That does it for us today. Up tomorrow, we plan to talk to the Navy to better understand what they called a swarm team, why it was brought in to find the source of contaminants in the military's drinking water. If it's not fuel, then what is it? What is on your mind? Leave your feedback on our talkback line, 808-792-8217, or email talkback at hawaiipublicradio.org. You can find our archive shows online on our website or at your favorite podcast store. I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us tomorrow for more of the conversation.